So I'm Michael Berry from Princeton University, one of the co-organizers, which is, I guess, part of the reason why I have to introduce myself. Could we maybe just turn the lights down a little bit? Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about today are population neural codes in the retina. And by way of a sort of very general introduction, of course, in neuroscience, we've almost exclusively studied the properties of single neurons because it's easy to do. But of course, even the most simple behaviors involve many neurons, hundreds, even thousands of neurons in any one single station within a sensory motor pathway. And so, if we want to understand the brain, we really need to go beyond single neurons and begin to appreciate the properties of populations. And so, when you think of population neural codes, there are a couple kind of very basic concepts that are really fundamental. One of them is functional diversity of the population. As we all know, neurons are not all the same. They have a wide range of functional properties, and when we want to look at any given population, we're going to want to understand the diversity of function within that population. In the retina, this, by the way, is a picture where we stained the ganglion cells with a retrograde label, so we put the optic nerve in a dye. And the dye goes back into just the ganglion cells. So you can see axon bundles that came from the optic nerve and cell bodies. In this case, we zapped a few of the cells with a laser, which caused them to fluoresce with a different wavelength. And so those cell bodies are yellow, and you can kind of see some of their dendritic field. As Peter kind of mentioned yesterday, there are really many of these retinal ganglion cells looking at any one point in visual space, and I'll describe measurements of exactly how many in this talk. Okay, so we want to know how those ganglion cells are arranged spatially to cover visual space. But then, probably the most important notion here is kind of the concept of synergy or redundancy. That's basically saying, given that we already know a lot of things about single neurons, what's different about the population that we didn't kind of already know from the single neurons? Synergy, of course, is where the population as a whole has kind of combinations of neuronal firing patterns that mean something different than the meaning of their individual symbols, and that can give you more information about the stimulus. Similarly, neurons could many neurons could be encoding the same thing, and that could give rise to redundancy. So this is really, I think, one of the more important kind of concepts in understanding a population code. What's sort of different than the individual neurons? Okay, Peter gave really a great overview of retinal organization, so I don't want to go into it too much. He mentioned that there are five major classes of cells, and anatomically, based mostly on anatomy, also on some molecular markers and function. We think they divide up into a number of classes, and one of the probably the more important functional principles of this organization is the idea that so you have these different kinds of bipolar cells that Peter described, and they send an axon into different depths in this region of contacts called the interplexiform layer. And the ganglion cells have dendrites that reach up also into specific depths within that interplexiform layer. And so a given ganglion cell is kind of reading out different kinds of information about the stimulus depending on kind of where in this kind of vertical direction it sends its dendrites and how widely they extend. And this information that they sample is, you know, greatly kind of complicated by the many types of amacrine cells that have these kind of complex and specific patterns of connections in the inner plexiform layer. Okay, so you can learn a lot about, let's say, the function of a ganglion cell by just observing where its dendrites are. If you look at this circuit kind of from the top, what you find in many cases is that retinal ganglion cells have this kind of beautiful organization where their dendritic fields kind of tile all of the space in the inner plexiform layer, and you know the dendrites of neighboring neurons are kind of just barely touching, and they avoid too much overlap. This is you know some of what's known about ganglion cell types from anatomy. Okay, so of course you know there are many possible ways you could imagine that a population of neurons would divide up the job of representing visual scenes. The nervous system has chosen a particular way of doing that, and one of the you know the principles that's very useful in trying to understand why the nervous system is configured the way it is sort of this notion of coding efficiency or you know optimization of function that you know has been a major theme of the meeting. So Peter mentioned a number of ways that retinal processing and circuitry is, you know, very good or optimal with respect to some purpose. And I just want to briefly mention a couple, you know, kind of very basic forms of efficiency of the retinal code. One very basic form is that the impulse response function of most neurons is biphasic. So a stimulus that excites it inhibits it a short while later. And of course, that'll turn a constant stimulus into a pulse. And so you can kind of think of that as even a very basic form of prediction. You know, the retina is going to assume the stimulus is kind of the same, or you know, the brain is going to assume the stimulus is the same, unless the retinal code tells it that something has just changed. In addition, there are many forms of adaptation in the retina. So imagine stimuli kind of are drawn from you know some distribution out there in the world. The response function of many retinal neurons will kind of match this distribution, so that goes from minimum to maximum over the kind of the range of stimuli that are encountered. And if that range changes, the response distribution of the neuron actually changes in a way to match the range of stimuli out there in the world. So these are just, you know, a couple examples of ways that the retinal code is efficient. And then these sort of ideas of efficiency, of course, can be applied to the population. So cells of a given functional type are thought to be roughly independent because the receptive fields don't overlap. You know, they tile. And then cells of different types are thought to be roughly independent because they're sensitive to different visual features, you know, like increases in light intensity versus decreases in light intensity. Of course, natural scenes have very strong spatial correlations. So because the stimulus is correlated over a long distance in space, you know, naively you would think that would cause adjacent ganglion cells to have correlated function even though their receptive fields don't overlap. However, this notion of decorrelation introduced back in the 50s by Barlow and refined by Attic, and the basic idea there is that the center-surround antagonism of the receptive field can reduce those correlations, and so the resulting retinal code still might be very efficient. There are many cell types. What?
There is only one cell of each type.
Well, that's That's been seen for some cell types. What it'll basically show you is that that's not true for most cell types. So we'll get to that in a moment. This is sort of, I would say, kind of a preconception about the population code based strongly on anatomy, where there's some very beautiful cases of tiling of the ganglion cell receptive fields, and sort of, you know, theoretical motivation that efficiency is what you want in the population. Okay, so in our lab, we want to test these notions of try to understand the population code of ganglion cells, and the technique we use is we have a multi-electrode array, which is a bunch of little metal electrodes on a glass slide, and you can take the retina out of the eye of the animal and put it with the ganglion cells facing the electrodes, and you can kind of hold it there close enough so that when the ganglion cell fires a spike, you get a good signal on the electrode. You can amplify it. And then we use a computer monitor to present sometimes simple but sometimes complex stimuli that are focused with optics down onto the photoreceptor layer. So in this way, we can record from many ganglion cells simultaneously. So I'll get to that. Of course, it depends on the number of electrodes. So we have arrays with. Let me just continue a little bit. So I was doing experiments like this as a postdoc in Marcus Meister's lab, and there we're able to record from many cells simultaneously, but actually a small fraction of neurons over the array. And so one of the things we've wanted to do in our lab is to record from a much larger fraction of all the cells to get a more complete sampling of the ganglion cell output. And so I'm going to show you that we think we can record from all or nearly all of the ganglion cells over the array. And the basic idea is that we use a much denser electrode array. So the spacing here is about 30 microns, which turns out to be the decay length of signals emanating from an individual ganglion cell. And so what happens is when any one cell fires a spike, you're going to see sort of a pattern of activity over many of the electrodes. Because that signal strength decays quite sharply with distance, when different cells fire a spike, they're going to produce a kind of a different pattern of activity on the array. We're going to use that different pattern to distinguish, which cell fired the spike. Generally, in extracellular recording, you're really limited not so much by being able to detect any sort of signal at all, but more by being able to uniquely identify it as being a single neuron. And so we're going to use sort of the dense array and the fact that, and kind of a spike sorting routine that uses the signal on every electrode to tell all the spikes apart. We've sort of done this quite a bit in salamander, which is kind of our mainstay prep, but also we have a number of recordings in guinea pig and mouse. So this project using the dense array new spike sorting techniques is something done by a postdoc, Ronen Segev. And so So you can distinguish the axonal spikes from somatic spikes by their shape. axonal spikes have a sort of a triphasic waveform where they go positive, negative, and a little bit of a rebound. Somatic spikes, are wider, start out negative, and are biphasic in shape. And so you can tell these waveforms apart. Usually these axonal spikes we can't cleanly isolate, and kind of makes sense because if you look at the staining pattern, you can see there are these kind of bundles of axons. So there are many axons, very close to each other. So usually we can't isolate a sort of a clean spike train from those signals. Every now and then we actually can, and what happens then is that the receptive field is kind of off the edge of the, far from the array. So we're confident that we don't get any axonal spike trains isolated here. So here's just an example of kind of three of these patterns of activity on the array when a cell fires a spike. And just to give a tiny bit of detail, what we do is we sort of look in order to find these templates, we look in the raw data and we find all the instances where the ganglion cell fires a spike all by itself, like uncorrupted by spikes from other cells. And that's typically a very small fraction of all the spikes that it fires, but it's plenty of spikes in order to find this average pattern. And so it's actually very easy to find these isolated spikes and get the template, but since that's a small fraction of all the spikes, that wouldn't be a good spike sorting technique by itself. But it is good for finding a template. And then basically when we see signals in the raw data, we use kind of a simple iterative matching algorithm to fit templates to the raw data. Using mean squared error as an error function plus an additional penalty for each spike each template that you've added, because it's increasingly unlikely to have many spikes overlapping in a short stretch of the data, and so we get a number of cleanly isolated spike trains out of that, and to try to see how complete our recording is from the patch of the retina. Remember, we labeled the ganglion cells with a dye, and so what we can do is we can count the number of labeled cells that are on or kind of right on the boundary of the array, and we compare that to the number of cells that we recorded, and you can see that the numbers correspond very well. So there's at this size, there's some heterogeneity in the ganglion cell density, so there's kind of a wide range of number of cells over the array, but you get the same number in the recordings. You maybe get about 20% more, and we think that's because we're recording a few cells that are a little ways off of the array. So you might wonder if the dye is labeling all the ganglion cells. And so what we did is we made an independent estimate of the ganglion cell density by counting axons in the optic nerve. And basically that agrees to within about 10%. But of course there are error bars and all these anatomical measurements. So we think the bottom line is that we're recording, let's say, in the range of kind of 80 to 100% of the ganglion cells over the array. We have some experiments in guinea pig where that seems to be true, but maybe some other experiments where it's a little bit less. We tried to take the template and figure out which soma it came from, and that didn't quite work. It was the couple cells, right next to each other, and there's actually a membrane between the ganglion cells and the array that that in principle kind of distorts the current paths somewhat. And so we I guess we don't know. I mean, all we know is that we can't uniquely match a template to a soma, and we sort of wish that we could. We're talking to Peter about ways of figuring out which cell corresponds to the electrical recording, and then try to look at the dendrites of that cell, and that's something that we're working on. Okay, so when you've record all these cells, one of the most basic ways to characterize their function is to map the receptive field. We do that by using flickering checkerboard. So that's kind of white noise and space-time, and usually also in color. And take the average stimulus pattern preceding a spike. I think people have kind of talked about this before. Here's an example of what that looks like. Here's the spatial pattern. And we'll often fit a two-dimensional Gaussian to the receptive field center. Here's the temporal pattern for the three different guns of the monitor that are scaled with different color ratios. So this particular neuron had no color sensitivity, because the impulse response function is kind of the same for all three colors. Okay, so one of the things that we find when we do this is just extreme diversity of ganglion cell function. So here I'm plotting this temporal impulse response function for a little over 100 ganglion cells in salamander. There are a few kind of classes that come out pretty distinctly if you kind of use various clustering algorithms. There's sort of a fast on cell. There's a slow on cell. This red biphasic off cell tends to be pretty distinct with most clustering algorithms. And then the rest of the stuff is kind of a smear of functional properties, and we tend to divide it into three groups. The slow off group is kind of a pure off cell, and the medium monophasic and biphasic are all kind of on off cells if you stimulate them with flashes of light. No. We've never seen color selective cells in the salamander.
Second
before the spike. So, this is a latency of about 50 milliseconds. Yeah, for.
This is all from one retina.
This is from three retinas. But we see examples of these cell classes from, let's say, all three retinas. There's definitely some prep to prep variability.
Is this a sample of population, or what I see here are the right proportions of the cells?
Yeah, well, so the idea is that if we're recording, all of the cells over a patch of the retina, that this is an unbiased sample of the whole population. It's certainly possible. In terms of recording cells, you always have a bias for bigger cells that produce stronger signals. There's probably going to be a little bit of bias because, I mentioned we think we can get some of the cells that are a little ways off the array, and those are probably going to be big cells. The staining, gave about the same cell density as the axon count, so I don't think there's a whole lot missing there. So I think it's, a relatively unbiased sample of the population. Okay, and then one of the things we can then do is we can calculate you know, take, let's say, the average receptive field area, just multiply by the cell density, and that tells you the total coverage factor of the ganglion cell receptive field. So that's, you know, how many receptive fields are looking at every single point in visual space, which I guess Misha had asked about earlier, and that number is 55 or maybe 60, something like that. So, you know, quite a lot of coverage of the ganglion cells. In salamander, it turns out that there's really only one cell type that shows much evidence of tiling. In most cases, you know, we find, you know, cells with kind of very similar function that overlap, you know, strongly. So most of the cells don't tile. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the one sigma ellipse of the Gaussian that's been fit to the spatial profile.
So does that mean the center or small?
The center. Yeah. So that's the, you know, roughly the location of the receptive field center of that neuron.
But I thought you said earlier that the receptive fields do not overlap.
Well, they do. In salamander, there are some differences in guinea pig. So there are some species differences here. The anatomy that I showed you earlier, that anatomy, for instance, was done in the monkey retina. So there are basically there are a few types of ganglion cells that I think, you know, really truly tile, and the anatomy shows that. And then there are a lot of ganglion cells that don't quite tile.
What is angular?
They overlap
Yeah.
Were built in basic responses to check them. Yeah. How do we know that if there was some more complex stimulus, it would turn out that it's simply the response was simple stimulus that overlapped with this?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess from measurement like this, we can't really tell. But there are some other kind of measurements that we've done that I'll show you a little bit later that kind of address that question.
Yeah. So they overlap relate somehow to the special resolution, angular resolution of the visual system at all. And so there's a large overlap. You assume that there's some blurring.
You know, I think that's not necessarily true. I think kind of naively, the spatial resolution of the population would have to do with the cell density, not regardless of in salamander they're pretty big. These are several degrees because the animal only has about 50,000 ganglion cells. You know, whereas the human eye has maybe 1.5 million, so it has much coarser visual acuity. I mean, it you know, there are some behavioral measurements on the salamander, and it turns out that it can actually do some form of hyperacuity, which is kind of resolved drifting gratings that are have a wavelength smaller than a photoreceptor, but you know, of course, that you know, that a property like that doesn't, you know, really connect to these measurements directly, because what could be happening is that the neuron has a bunch of kind of subunits in its receptive field that individually have kind of their own small receptive field, detect the grating, sum that up nonlinearly. Yeah, so I mean, we you know, really do lots of things to see if we can convince ourselves that's the same neuron, and it's not.
So my question actually is,
Because so I trusted that, actually. I wasn't going to doubt you there. The question is the retina of the salamander very irregular in its distribution of cells? Because why, if there's two cells that close together, why isn't there a third cell and a fourth cell and a fifth cell that make it?
But the thing is the array right now is still smaller than we'd like. So the area of the array is actually smaller than the receptive field area. So we have plans at some point to scale up the array. You'd like it to kind of be a fair amount bigger, so you could see a lot of the neighboring cells that are functionally very very similar to that.
Where as you compute, there are enough cells in the retina to tile the entire retina with such.
Oh yeah, yeah. So, remember that the total coverage is about 60. So if you divide the population into here we're kind of doing a little bit kind of finer splitting, maybe 10 classes from that patch of retina. So average coverage is still 6 for those 10 classes.
So you only have one chip and one small group of retro covering small area.
Right. So actually, our array has two small patches, and farther away than the extent of the surround. So you're kind of getting independent function.
This one array, of course, is going to tend to bias sample the neurons with the same locations in the receptor.
It's only going to pick up neurons in that little spatial location, but the retinal circuit is very highly modular, so the kind of circuits in the retina are repeated in space. So basically, because of that modularity, if you record from a big enough patch, and maybe we'd like to have a little bit bigger array, really to do that a bit more completely, but if you record from a big enough patch, like, you should see everything that's there. And Peter pointed out that there certainly are some kind of differences in properties as a function of eccentricity, so whether you're closer to the center of the visual field or out towards the periphery, but that as far as we can tell, that's kind of a quantitative difference in how big are the receptive fields and what are the density of the cells, rather than you finding entirely different cell types. So let me also show results from the guinea pig retina. The guinea pig is a more ordered retina than the salamander. So here are maybe 30, 35 cells from one patch. Let's see, so first of all, if you just compute the total coverage, it's still about 60, as it was in the salamander. If you get really picky about cell types, you might say there are as many as 20 cell types. When you kind of observe multiple neurons of the same cell type in one patch, so here I'm showing them in some different colors. So their receptive fields overlap quite a lot, but within a single type, they avoid direct overlap. These are all one sigma radii. So in the guinea pig, it looks like the ganglion cells basically all kind of form a mosaic, but you can see that there's kind of considerable overlap. So they're not kind of tiling at one sigma radius. Most of the cells have a fair degree of overlap. Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, Steve Backus and Marcus published a paper in which they actually looked at intracellular recordings and showed that the baseline membrane potential for the different cells can be quite different, and that got when they did the reverse correlation, that got reflected back into the receptor field estimates. I'm just curious if that's an issue here, if you're comparing different cells and their receptive fields. I'm wondering if that's. Obviously you can't record that with the array, but I'm just wondering if that's something that.
You're kind of asking, can we, you know, divide the cells into more classes, or, you know, find additional differences? It's certainly possible. We're trying pretty hard to use lots of different stimuli to do functional classification. What it seems like is you know, the most robust feature is really this spike-triggered average. That like small differences in that really seem to correspond to kind of a lot of functional differences, and some of the other properties don't help you very much in classifying the neurons because it's just all over the map.
I guess what I'm saying is that the same neuron with the same spike-triggered average in two different baseline potentials.
Yeah,
that experiment and estimate the spike triggered average, you get two different things. I'm just curious if that plays into this.
If the neuron has a different underlying membrane potential, it should have a very different average firing rate with the same stimulus. And that definitely happens, but then the spike triggered average ends up being, virtually the same.
Michael, I'm having trouble thinking about the resolving power of this mosaic because I'm not familiar with the one sigma unit. So how close are they to the Nyquist limit, which would be that they would overlap at about 50% of the response?
The Nyquist limit from the photoreceptors?
No, from the actual half-width of the peak of the central Gaussian of the receptor field.
I think it's right at the Nyquist limit for cells like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Heinz Vesely has kind of an idea about the ideal coverage being closer to 3 because of the sort of Nyquist sampling for a grading. In this case, these neurons have a coverage factor of about 4.
If the mosaic ganglion cells wants to get the most spatial information out of its array, then it actually wants to overlap by about this amount.
Yeah, about 3 or 4. So that's not it definitely makes some sense, and it turns out that if you read the anatomy papers very, very carefully, most of the anatomical types people have talked about have coverage, in the range of maybe more like 3. There's sort of a very prominent cell type, parasol and monkey, alpha cell, and other mammals that has a coverage closer to 1. And I think people have really kind of focused a lot on that cell type, and it may not be, I don't think it is representative of the population. So the receptor field organization, I've shown you there's really a great deal of functional diversity in the population and a lot of spatial overlap. There's some real limitations to understanding the function of the neuron from just its receptive field, so imagine a couple receptive fields here sampling a natural scene. The spike-triggered average is a simplified description of the probability distribution of stimuli given a spike. It's just the average of that distribution, and in general, the distribution may not be very well characterized by only the average. This kind of coverage factor that we've been talking about has a pretty arbitrary definition, this one sigma radius, and you have to decide, you know, which cells are the same functional type, which is kind of tricky. And we also know that due to adaptation, the receptive field can kind of shift around in a number of ways depending on the stimulus conditions. So what we'd really like to do is, first of all, use natural scenes in our analysis rather than these flickering white noise checkerboards, and also use information theory so we don't need to make assumptions like, you know, the spike-triggered average is a complete description of the neuron. Okay, so the approach here will basically be to look at the similarity in function between two neurons by calculating their redundancy. And so that's the information that one cell tells you about the stimulus, plus information that the other cell tells you, minus the information that you get with the joint responses of both cells. And one of the things that you'll see in a moment is that the information rate in bits per second is all over the map. It depends very strongly on the firing rate of the neuron, which has a broad distribution. So we'd like to to form a normalized quantity here to kind of put everything on the same scale. And so what we do is we divide by the minimum of the two individual informations, and you can show that that's an upper bound on the redundancy, because the joint responses can't lose any more information than the smaller of the two individual cells. So this will be a quantity that is zero if the two cells are functionally independent, and it runs up to maximum value of one if the spike trains are identical, or if one cell is a subset of the other cell. And so benefits of a quantity like this is that if the neuron has kind of sensitivity to many visual features, all of that shows up in this measurement. If the response is kind of nonlinear or adaptive, we're going to repeat the stimulus. So any adaptation that's kind of deterministically related to the stimulus, we're going to capture in this measure. Non-Poisson noise, correlations of multiple spikes, like all of this stuff is included in the information. Also, we don't need to decide which functional type the two cells are. We just calculate this thing. And finally, one of the properties of mutual information that I think is very nice is the data processing inequality, which says that if you have a signaling chain, however much information you have at an early stage, like the retinal ganglion cells, you can never get any more information later on. And when you're looking at individual neurons, this isn't necessarily so useful, because at the next stage, that neuron could get information from like hundreds of other cells in the population. But if you're really looking at the whole population, then the data processing inequality can become very powerful. And so I think that's another reason why it's very useful to use information theory. It can be negative if the cells are synergistic, and with this normalization, it can be even less than minus one. Yeah. Okay. So, this is work that's primarily been done by postdoc Jason Puhala. Okay. So, using natural movie clips, of course, one wonders what counts as a natural movie. And our basic approach is to sample a variety of scenes that we think represent some of the kind of important categories of natural visual stimuli. And we think those categories are, obviously intrinsic motion, that's like something out there moving in the world, but also you have to keep in mind that whenever your eyes move or your body moves, the whole retinal image kind of slips, has this wide field motion that is just, tremendously strong stimulus with respect to ganglion cells. And so we also want to include motion from eye movements and from walking around. And of course, our clips are going to have some bias towards things happening, because otherwise all the cells are silent and it's really boring. You know, we're going to rely on the fact that there are a number of statistical invariances, like Dalway has described the spatiotemporal power spectrum of many natural scenes has the same form. You know, so these aren't absolutely perfect natural images for the salamander or the guinea pig, but they're you know, just a whole lot closer to what it sees in real life than our checkerboards. Okay, so here are just a few examples. Here is, you know, a tree kind of swaying in the breeze. Here's conspecific. There's a Mr. Salamander. Sees a fish. Goes after him. Oh, missed. Okay. Happens a lot for the salamander. Okay, here some examples of wide field motion. This is, you know, kind of taking a camera, walking through the woods. Here is an example of saccadic eye movements, where you're kind of looking around with the camera. You know, so these are kind of, you know, important categories of natural scenes, and we want to use all those stimuli in our experiments. So, what do you get when you stimulate the retina with these natural scenes? You essentially get responses that are pretty similar to what you find with something like a flickering checkerboard, you know, namely these kind of, you know, sparse responses. So these are spike rasters from one neuron. You know, dot is a spike time, 250 trials of the same movie, and you can see that the neuron is, you know, responding quite precisely in the same at the same time during the movie clip. Okay, so. And then we can, you know, using these repeated trials of the stimulus, we can, you know, use direct methods to estimate the information rate of the neuron in these different movie clips. And what we find when we look at the whole population, something very similar to what Peter described yesterday, which is that if you plot the information rate versus the average firing rate in the movie clip for all the neurons, the cells pretty much all fall in a line. So this is a log-log plot, and so the line in this case has a slope of 0.8. So it means that that you kind of have this power law dependence, where the information rate is prefactor 4 bits per spike times firing rate to the 0.8 power over over this whole range, and so here I've shown with the symbols those six different functional types from the salamander, and you know the different functional types kind of all fall in this line, except the slow on cell seems to be consistently have less information than everybody else, but
Michael, in your formulation, you got the probability of the response given the stimulus.
Right.
How do you define the stimulus? Is it grade level within the picture, or is it the frame number? What is it?
You don't need to find the stimulus. You know, the idea is basically that the stimulus is very high dimensional, and so at each point in time during this recording, the stimulus is different. So, you know, what we're essentially looking at is kind of the probability of finding spike words at each point in time during the stimulus. And so we get the total entropy of the spike train by averaging over all time during the stimulus to get a distribution of spike words, and take the entropy of that distribution, and then at each point in time, we're using the repeats. So you know, you have to have, you know, 100 odd repeats in order to sample the distribution of spike words at each point in time. But you know, that's what you're seeing here. So you're getting kind of many examples of what what does a spike train look like at that point in time.
If I was an astronomer, astronomer or a TV engineer, I wouldn't classify this as pictorial information. This is just how reliably the neuron will respond in a sequence of events, given that the sequence repeats.
Was exactly repeated, yeah.
So it's very different from, say, information that people have defined in terms of the amount of information that's projected optically onto the retina and sampled by photoreceptors.
No, I mean it is the mutual information between, you know, this complex stimulus and the spike train, you know, given although it depends on parameters like the no,
where another salamander was, unless it already knew the movie.
Not at all. Right. So that's, you know, both a benefit and a problem with the method. I mean, it's a big benefit because you can use this method equally well for natural scenes as for, you know, a flash in two different locations. But of course it's going to be very hard to figure out exactly what things the salamander knows about this stimulus. That's right. So, yeah, just a few of the details: 5 millisecond time bins, words out to 4 digits, kind of extrapolating with word length, and you know, the bias from finite number of repeats is pretty low, and kind of random error estimated again from kind of a simple model of the spike train is pretty low. Yeah. I haven't looked at that over.
But your underlying assumption is there is no correlation for the word to the next one.
yeah, that's right. So, so basically, you know, you kind of sample these words of different numbers of digits, and you look at how the entropy depends on the number of digits, and and that gives you, you know, a way of taking into account correlations on a little bit longer time scale than the word length itself, but not, you know, infinitely long.
Right.
So,
and you're saying basically, you at some point, like 100 milliseconds or something, you don't get extra information by counting them as a long.
Yeah. So. So it's a little okay. So the sort of thing you can do is you can ask, you know, if I have like 100 millisecond time bin, and you know, what is sort of the difference in entropy if I assume all of those are independent versus if I sample 2 successive bins, you know, completely and get the entropy rate. And those correlations, it kind of depends. But if you look at, let's say, just the autocorrelation function of the spike train, you know, that you know, kind of has an envelope that dies off, and you know, 20, 30, 40 milliseconds, something like that. It has, you know, a little bit of a tail out to longer time scales. And so if you do this comparison I mentioned, you get a little, you get some difference. you know, it's a little hard to actually quantify that, because when you do this extrapolation with the words, you're capturing that a little bit. you know, so I would say, you know, correlations on, you know, time scale beyond a few hundred milliseconds, you know, probably do change information by a little bit, and this method doesn't capture them. Yeah.
One more thing, which also relates a bit to what Simon asked: if you take the words, take parts of the movie, you get usually very similar numbers. And if you take successive words or kind of interleave them, you the words that are kind of only sample words that we in different timings of different intervals between them, you still get very similar results. So kind of so the, while there is correlation that decays with the length, you still get very similar results if you try to focus on the word you have far more.
Yeah, so it seems to be a pretty small effect, but I can't really put a, I'm not comfortable putting an exact number on it. I don't know if Elad has more of a view of how big it is. Yeah.
Good question, by coding efficiency, do you mean comparing the Poisson
process to the So here, I'm looking at information rate divided by entropy rate. And that entropy rate. So the coding efficiency is about 50% for all the neurons. If you assume that this power law is kind of really what the neurons are doing, then coding efficiency is not exactly constant as a function of firing rate, but it's pretty close. And then the last thing to kind of point out here, this Garrett was asking, I don't know where he's gone. Is that if you look at neurons of a single functional type, you see they just have a tremendous range in their firing rates, kind of over, a factor of at least 100, maybe more than that. So.
So can you comment on the average firing rate?
Something like that. It's lower in amphibian than it is in mammal, I'll just show that on the next slide. the amphibian has a lower metabolic rate, and it kind of has let's say maybe a little bit different kind of cost benefit between. Getting information from its retina versus, let's say, the energetic price it has to pay for it because it does have a much lower metabolic rate. So kind of related to that, if you here in blue I'm plotting all the data I had before, and then in red I'm showing similar results from the rabbit, So again, there's this kind of information scaling, Peter saw in the guinea pig. The difference is it has about the same slope on this log-log plot, but has a different prefactor. So instead of kind of 4 bits per spike in salamander, you get 2.6 about in the mammal. So the coding efficiency is about a third in rabbit like it is in guinea pig. So I think it's kind of interesting that there's this systematic difference between amphibians and mammals. I mean there's certainly some kind of functional constant here, because for all stimuli, for all cell types, this relationship is held, but then there's this kind of systematic difference between the amphibian and mammal, that may sort of have to do with this kind of, given the different metabolic rates of the animal, what is sort of the value of the information.
Do you have an idea why this flow is one day?
No. So generically, it should probably be sublinear, because as you fire more and more often, spikes become less surprising, and so you're going to get less information out of them. So you expect that relationship to be sublinear. What I'm kind of showing over here is that. Actually, the neurons sort of have this this kind of correspondence where when the cell has a higher firing rate, its temporal precision is considerably better. So that seems to let's say partially compensate for the fact that the spikes are less surprising, because you know, everything else being equal, you get more information from responses that are more precise. So I think that's related to the power being 0.8, but I don't have kind of a more detailed kind of description.
Usually when you find cells that are very accurate, it's because they're responding to the temporal component of the
movies. Yeah, so I think there's some correlation here, but you know, so like the red neurons are the most biphasic, kind of the highest temporal frequency neurons, and they're still, you know, a bit of a range of their precision in that population, and it does kind of correspond, you know, to their firing rate. And you know, remember, we see neurons with, you know, firing rates different by about a factor of 100 in the whole population, and so, you know, there is quite a quite a range.
It's, you know, the question is being asked: why is there a relationship between firing rate and inflammation? And it's the case that the high firing rate cells are also the ones that are responding to the temporal derivative, mm-hmm. essentially, of the movies, then those are going to be the most accurate, and they're going to give you the most information about that component, which is the one component you can sort of measure pretty well in the natural images. Because all the other stuff that they're coding, you don't really know about.
No, I mean, we're not really sure what you should be measuring in the movie. I mean, the total entropy rate of the movie is just massively larger than what any one neuron is extracting. So they're all kind of very selective filters of some sort. Yeah.
Just go back and tell me exactly what you think the information in the movie is. Like what are you getting entropy? Like the
yeah. So I probably should have had a slide for this, but the you know, so the information between stimulus and response, you know, can be written entropy of the stimulus minus entropy of the stimulus given the response, and there you'd need to characterize the entropy of the stimulus, but you can also, you know, write it the other way, and that's the way we've done it here, where you sort of only need to kind of parameterize the response, not the whole stimulus.
I guess what I'm asking is, what do you think the relevant stimulus is driving
the cell? Well, you know, so when anything big moves, like lots of cells fire, you know, so sure, it's always a you know, kind of a change in light intensity on the cell's receptive field center. That's basically what causes it to fire. It's a little bit more abstract than that.
Are you building a predictor from the movie to the response?
No.
No.
The conditional entropy we're just sampling by repeating the stimulus. So we're not trying to use the response to re-estimate the The vertical what?
The vertical information rate doesn't really depend on the stimulus. Well, maybe it depends on the stimulus. But the horizontal, the average firing rate, it depends on the movie, right? If you show a different movie, there'll be a different firing rate.
Yeah.
So whereas the vertical characterizes information transmission from the image to the response, the horizontal seems to be dependent on the stimulus.
They're both
dependent
on the stimulus.
Yeah.
Look at the case there. Look.
It didn't have to be that way.
Yes.
You can imagine that a movie in which the cell will not respond at all.
No.
And we wouldn't know that. I mean, I guess if we found him responding to some other movie, but I mean, basically, you know, what I'd say from this data is that every neuron is a very selective filter. You know, so there's much, much more data, or, you know, entropy in the stimulus, and the neuron is selecting a tiny subset of that to encode, and it does so quite reliably, and you know, because the coding efficiency is a half, which is relatively high, you know, so it's kind of a sparse and precise code, and and you know, and it's a little hard to say, like, what, why should the firing rate be, you know, 1 hertz or 5 hertz? You know, that's the sort of thing that you know, we'd like to be able to understand better about the neurons, because they are highly adaptive. So they're, you know, they're changing their firing rates by factors of 2 and 5, depending on the stimulus.
Are you implying that the cells are firing because they are individual filters and they are firing according to their likes or dislikes, and that way they are more independent, and you're measuring it by, of course, the firing rate gives you whatever you measure from showing the stimulus. Now this axis shows you what you measure and to interpret what you're trying to say. Or the bottom line, are you saying the different neurons are giving the different rates corresponding to different stimuli?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying so they're independent.
Well, this doesn't. This is just for single neurons. It says nothing about independence or non-independence. It just says that you know, in the population, you know, neurons, for whatever reason, have a wide variety of set points, so they have kind of very different firing rates to you know, the same ensemble of stimuli. But you know, no matter what their sort of set point here is in terms of firing rate, you know, they give you kind of a corresponding amount of information, which is you know, fair amount, like, you know, 4 or 5 bits per spike. You know, so
how do you quantify individual neurons or individual filters, for example?
How do you quantify
individual or characterize whatever individual neurons or individual filters?
Well, I mean, this well, you know, that's hard for natural scenes. So I mean, that's a problem that, you know, that the field needs to work on, and we haven't solved. You know, for simpler stimuli, you know, there are techniques like you know, covariance matrix analysis, where you can identify kind of a small subset of the stimulus space that the neuron cares about, and you know, in some other work that I won't talk about here, we've basically found that those methods can recover 100% of the information for some fraction of the neurons, and for a population of neurons, we get about 90% of the information about spatially uniform flicker from methods like that. So for simpler stimuli, there are some good methods to characterize you know, what features in the stimulus does the cell care about, but those methods don't yet work so well for natural scenes. So it's something we still need to work on. Yeah.
So if you make the measurement in salamander and different body temperatures in salamander, does that just shift the curve? So is the power law dependent on the same qualitatively and just changes the average firing rate, or is it qualitatively changing?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, we always measure at room temperature, so at least for these experiments. No, I mean, it's kind of normal, right? I mean, we have done some experiments where we systematically varied the temperature, and basically at higher temperature the filters all speed up and get more biphasic. At lower temperature they all get slower. But we didn't characterize kind of the information transmission. Yeah.
So this rabbit,
no, the rabbit's at 36 or something. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
So yeah. If you take the set of cells that you identify through your spike triggered averaging and put them in a cluster and then do your information analysis on that, do you see any kind of features popping out of those clusters that are different than other ones?
Let's see. So I mean, this information analysis doesn't give you any. It doesn't tell you anything about the stimulus, right?
No, I'm just saying that. Let's say on that curve right there.
Yeah.
You now would put ones that were in the same cluster from the spectrum to average, they would be in the same place on the curve.
Well, yeah. That's what I. Whoops. That's what I showed here. So you know, the different symbols are different functional types, and they have they pretty much cover the curve. There's a little bit of a dependence where the slower cells, tend to, on average, have lower firing rates, but it's still a broad distribution.
Those classifications come from spike trigger average, or
yeah.
Spike trigger average is showing basically cells that have similar receptor fields.
That classification is from spike triggered average and is also consistent with kind of flash response. You know, flash response, there are like three categories of neurons, on, off, and on, off. And they match up with these six types. Okay. Yeah.
As long as we're stuck on this slide.
Okay. Yeah.
There's such a huge linear dependence between firing rate and information. Is there any point, when I ask a normal physiologist question, which is there any point of using information at all?
Well, maybe not here. I mean, maybe you could just measure the firing rate and have a pretty good guess about the information rate. Yeah. But you wouldn't have known that before you calculated this.
That is true.
contrary. So that's exactly the information is a very good measure. Forget about firing rate.
Well, I mean, you know, information is, I mean, I'd much rather know the information rate about a neuron than... Information's better, but firing rate's much easier to measure. What?
For example, the scale of rate doesn't tell you anything when the scale of information has a mean.
Yeah, but you know, the point is, you know, once you've measured this, maybe, you know...
Argument now, and I'm playing from a practical experimental physiologist point of view. Is there any use in using this measure for experimentalized rather than information? Just to say, the force rate says information is better.
I think you could frame both what Michael is reporting here and the similar result that Peter reported yesterday as a surprise. Right? There are many different types of cells under many different stimulus conditions. Which, much to your surprise, all fall along a single curve. So that means true that if you wanted to measure the information rate, you didn't have to do, apparently, anything fancy like in 100 repeats or so many seconds. You could have written that, you could close your eyes, figured out the firing rate,
and
this would
and popped it in the curve.
The same thing that Peter was showing yesterday for Nibig, and indeed, I guess it's not, there are other curves, there are other functional forms that fit this also fairly well. Right.
I mean,
for example, our log bar fits this curve reasonably well.
Pretty well. I mean, you know, definitely less well over. I mean, here this is a range of like 300 or something in firing rate. Over a smaller range, you can't distinguish.
And there's other measures that are going to be linear, will be related to firing rate. So when we calculate information in V1, we also calculate sparseness, and it turns out sparseness and information are almost perfectly linearly related. And of course, they're linearly related to firing rate, so they're all linked. Uh-huh. And again, they're linked through this association between the temporal frequency response of the cell and the inherent jitter, which is sort of what Mike very clearly explained earlier, that you might expect that a cell that fires less would be transmitting more information, but because a cell that fires less has more jitter, there's a trade-off.
Right.
So I guess there's a sort of philosophical sense in which it's more pleasing to have things in information rate. But from a practical, sort of experimental sense, what I was wondering is there a thing you can measure with information? Like maybe when we get to the multi-cell stuff,
yeah, well, that's
there will be measures that.
Yeah. So. there. Yeah, I mean that's kind of. I mean, maybe you know I could chat with you over lunch about you know variety of the. Yeah.
Which you didn't works. It's not just by the magical layer. Or any other layer, you're getting so much information.
In my experience, that only makes engineers happy.
Right?
In my experience, it only makes engineers and physicists happy.
It's a good reason.
That's a brain.
Yeah,
that's
because the biologist, you know, pretty close-minded about
your world. You're exactly right.
Okay, so I better move on here. What we wanted this was actually supposed to be a small detour to just tell you about single unit response properties before we go on and look at similarities between pairs or more than pairs of neurons. Here I'm just showing spike trains from a bunch of cells responding to a movie. Just to kind of illustrate that, let's say if we look at cells A and B, they're kind of these times where they fire together, but then B fires A doesn't, A fires B doesn't. There's this complex relationship between the firing patterns of these various different cells. So now what we're going to do is we're going to calculate the redundancy between pairs of neurons and in those normalized units that I measured. And here's what we get for about 2,000 cell pairs and a bunch of different movie clips. So plotting fractional redundancy versus cell pair distance. And you can see there's kind of a wide range of redundancy values in the population. They go up to almost 50%. So there's some pairs that are very, very redundant with each other. There's a kind of envelope where they decay, and past about 500 microns or so, you don't really see much redundancy. Doesn't seem to depend on the movie type, which surprised us a little bit. You might have thought that a saccadic eye movement, everybody fires together, but they're not particularly more redundant in the saccade movie. As was mentioned, this number can be negative, and that would mean that there's net synergy between pairs of cells, and we can't really convince ourselves that there's ever any net synergy in the population. Okay. So now. Pairs. Just pairs, yeah.
Maybe there are synergy properties in the higher order.
Yeah. Right.
But what's the strength of some of the synergy numbers?
200 microns is where a lot of the cells are touching. That's about the twice, that's like diameter of the receptive field, most cells. We also did this measurement with checkerboards, and here we can, one of the differences between checkerboards and movies is that the checkerboard has very little correlation in space or time. So now when we find redundancy between cells, this really has to do with their the circuitry of the retina. This isn't due to correlations in the stimulus. When we do that measurement, we find a fair amount of redundancy for neurons with overlapping receptive fields. Mostly dies off by around 200 micron spacing, which is where the receptive fields are just touching. So, most of this redundancy is cells with overlapping receptive fields. One of the things that kind of surprises us a bit is that how it depends on functional type. So the blue points are where the two cells in the pair are the same functional type, and red points is where they're different functional type. And there's not really, there's kind of interspersed values of redundancy. So when you assign cells to functional type using the spike-triggered average, that doesn't really imply that the cells are more functionally similar to each other than to cells of a different type. However, you know, you do see some patterns here. If the two cells in the pair, one of them is on type, the other is off type, then they're pretty much independent. This is salamander, yeah.
So I'm having a little trouble with the synergistic part. You're not seeing it, but I'm just curious, how would that get expressed? I mean, so an on-off pair, for example, you're saying is not displaying synergy, for example.
They're roughly independent. Well, I mean, so this is an average measure of, averaged over the entire spike train. I have time, which I look like I may not. It turns out that there are firing patterns produced by the cells that can be synergistic, particular firing patterns, but averaged over all of the possible firing patterns of the cells, there is no net synergy. So let's look at this in the mammal. This is a related measure, slightly different. And now I'm plotting the distance in normalized units. So one is where the receptive fields are just barely touching. And so again, you know, you can identify a lot of these cell types in the guinea pig retina. Brisk transient, brisk sustain, local edge detector. But the thing that you find is that, you know, cells of, let's say, one functional type are not don't necessarily share more information than, you know, cells of different functional type at the same distance apart. You know, so there's this kind of extensive mixing of visual information among cells of different functional type. And there are, you know, some kind of very broad differences within the population, functionally, where the cells really are independent. I mentioned if you have an on-off cell pair, these are all the blue points here. They're pretty much all independent. basically they're sparse enough that they end up being independent. So if you had on and off cells with very high firing rates, that they're spiking a lot of the time, then they would share information. And every once in a while, like, you know, some of these points, like, they're very high firing rate, both cells and in the pair. So that didn't need be true, but roughly, you know, for given that they're pretty sparse, they are independent. Similarly, if you have kind of a fast off cell and a slow off cell, they're roughly independent. Fast on, slow on, independent. You know, so I would say that there are probably, you know, based on this analysis, there are probably at least four independent kind of channels of information in the retina. But it's not true that, you know, all of these different functional types, which correspond to anatomical types, they're not all independent channels. You know, they often have very strong sharing of information with cells of different type.
Right. Question about that, I'm having trouble normalizing my brain. That's to say, if you have a sharing information here, all those bodies are
more than the blue. Messner was the sound of it, of course. From the previous these units are about the same as the fractional redundancy. Yeah, I mean a lot of them are right. You know, all the on-off pairs, you know, really don't. In the next couple slides, I'll kind of address that a little bit more, you know, sort of for the whole population. But basically, let's see. So let me go back to, you know, kind of these data for natural scenes. Let's see. So you know, the random error is it's actually not 5%. It's more like 1.5%. So basically, we kind of set a threshold of 5% for significance. Okay. So we'd say, you know, anything over 5% is statistically significant. You might wonder, you know, is that really big or not? Sure. One thing that, you know, is important to keep in mind is that the noisiness of neurons really limits their redundancy. So practically speaking, you can't get anywhere near one. You know, so if you you know, take these neurons with uniform flicker, you know, where every neuron gets exactly the same stimulus, you know, the average redundancy is maybe 30%, 25-30%. You know, so that's kind of the scale that is kind of large for a neuron that actually has some noise. Yeah.
So
like 20%. That's a fraction. It's not 0.2 is 20%. Most of them are close to zero.
Yeah, but that's most of them are then like 20%, not 20%.
So why don't I kind of continue with the looking at the population? So this is back at Salamander, and for the Salamander Natural Movies, and so I said, you know, 5% is kind of statistically significant. So what we're doing here is counting the fraction of cell pairs at a given distance that are significantly redundant. And so, you know, for nearby cells, it's about 40% in Salamander. And it dies off pretty quickly, you know, basically where the receptive fields overlap. But, you know, there are a lot of cells in, you know, distance of 400 microns. And so if you add it all up, what you get is, on average, one ganglion cell will have significant redundancy with 100 neighbors. You know, there might be, you know, 2,000, you know, cells in that, you know, out to 500 or 600 microns away. But so yes, it's I mean, well, you know, here's a measurement of what the fraction is. For very close cells, it's a high fraction. It dies off as the cells are separated. And, you know, and the point is there are just a lot of correlated cells in the population.
That's driven by the correlations of the stimulus, right? If you have the stimulus information in this information measure, it's a measure of the response.
Yeah.
These correlations in the stimulus that are occurring over space is going to drive that.
It turns out it's mostly driven by just the circuitry of the retina, because you get a similar number for the checkerboard.
Well, the checkerboard is moving over space too.
Checkers are small.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. That's what the checkerboard is. Yeah. Yeah. That's because they have overlapping receptive fields. Remember, the coverage factor in the population is 60.
Yeah, sure. You know, that's both factors. It's just I don't know how sort of how to normalize this down. I don't know how to subtract off the stimulus correlations from that.
Yeah, I don't think I made a slide of that figure, but you can do this count for, you know, movies and for checkerboard, and I think what is it for checkerboard? You know, movies it's like 110, checkerboards it's like 80 or something like that. You know, so it's smaller, but it's not much smaller. So then you can ask, okay, well how strong is the redundancy? So this is averaging all of the significantly redundant pairs, and you know, you get a little more than 10% for nearby cells, and it drops to 5%, which was the cutoff for identifying significant redundancy. So basically, it's pretty moderate, you know, average redundancy. But the point is that there are many pairs that have this redundancy. And so, so one thing you can do is define an overrepresentation factor, which for cell A, it's the sum of, this is now unnormalized, kind of bits per second redundancy with all of its neighbors, and then divide by the information that cell A conveys about the stimulus. And that's a measure of, you know, how much does the local population kind of say all the things that this one particular cell says. And if you average that over the population, you get about 10 or 11. So your average cell has its visual information represented 10 times over by the nearby population. And that's, you know again, the average pairwise redundancy is not always that high, but they're just a lot of pairs. And you know, you might, so in kind of a very simple model of the population that I could discuss later if people are interested, kind of a very simple model, the information in the entire population is the sum of single cells divided by their average overrepresentation. You know, that assumes no three-cell interactions and kind of uniformly distributed correlations. But you know, so basically, it suggests that, you know, the retina is about tenfold redundant. Yeah.
So could this be related to the point I was trying to make yesterday, which is that if you have two different cell types projecting in different places, that require information and use information. You might want to have the same some shared information, but same with the great. So in that sense, it would be, this is redundancy that might be efficient in some way.
Well, I'm not saying it's not useful.
Could this be related to that point?
Sure. They're kind of. Why don't I continue, because I think the next slide has some. Right. So the thing that we find very confusing about the population code is that when you look at, you know, the single neurons, they're sparse and precise and really very efficient, and they do all these things like adaptation that, you know, make them more efficient than if they didn't adapt. But then at the level of the population, you have there's a lot of functional diversity, a lot of overlap, and that gives rise to kind of high redundancy in the population. So what are some of the reasons why that might why you might want to build the code that way? I mean, of course, it doesn't have to be optimal, it doesn't have to be very good, but I'm sure evolution could figure out how to have, you know, five times fewer ganglion cells if that were, you know, a better way to do things. So, you know, in the spirit of much of the meeting, I think, you know, we should think about reasons why reasonably high redundancy might be useful. The kind of most obvious reason that comes to mind is error correction. If you have individual neurons that misfire sometimes, and you want to reliably get that information to the brain, you might want to have some redundancy to allow for error correction at the next stage of processing. But you know, there's sort of a, you know, very simple error correcting algorithm in kind of computer science. You want to send one bit reliably, just send it three times, and then, you know, the receiver takes two out of three as you know, the right answer. you know, that's kind of a very, you know, very robust error correcting code that then has redundancy of about a factor of 3. So it seems that the redundancy is perhaps a little bit, you know, higher than for kind of simple forms of error correction. So, you know, another idea is that, you know, maybe one of the issues is that there are some kind of behaviorally relevant events that you just want to make sure that you never miss. Like, you have to have complete certainty about particular things. You know, like if you're about to cross the road and there's, you know, a car coming, you know, you don't want to have like 90% probability you detect the car. I mean, you want to get to 100%, basically. So, you know, maybe the requirement that you know, you got these noisy neurons, you know, maybe it's really pretty hard to get to close to 100% reliability about certain stimulus features, and you want to kind of repeat the message a number of times to achieve that, and it gives you some kind of even higher redundancy. Another idea is of course that, you know, there can be benefits kind of beyond, you know, kind of the information content that have to do with the representation of the information. So if you have this very redundant code, then the redundancy itself can, or the over-representation can kind of be a form of passive attention whereby if, you know, some feature out in the stimulus is kind of over-represented by 20 neurons and another feature is represented by 2 neurons, you know, the brain might be able to get the appropriate information about both those things, but now when that one thing is, let's say, 10 times stronger, you know, then circuits in the brain can kind of focus more on that object in the world. So over-representation, you know, can kind of form a saliency map of the image. Another kind of possibility that we've looked at quite a lot, yeah. So we've kind of measured this kind of average over representation, but it's not, you know, certain stimulus events will cause a lot of neurons to fire. There are other times when only one neuron fires, you know, so there's kind of a, let's say, a broad distribution of how many neurons, you know, in a single patch that fire when certain local things happen. So then the kind of, you know, last idea is that if you have, you know, many neurons encoding, you know, local features in space, and the neurons are, you know, somewhat different functionally, but not completely independent, then it allows you to kind of have a combinatorial code where there's a different meaning you can associate with the firing of, you know, a couple neurons and the silence of a couple other neurons. And that sort of combinatorial code wouldn't be possible if all the neurons were independent. And basically we find that that's true. I'm kind of running short on time, so I'm going to try to kind of go through this really, really quickly. So the idea here is that what we're looking at is the information in particular multineuronal firing patterns. So not averaged over all of the responses of the neuron, but just for each particular type of response. And so, you know, for some event sigma, information in the time of occurrence of sigma about the stimulus is kind of a simple formula. It's just related to the event rate. And then we'll look at synergy of, you know, let's say a compound, you know, kind of a multineuronal firing pattern by comparing its information to the information of the constituent parts. And again, if you average over all of the response patterns that, you know, let's say two neurons produce, then you get the average synergy or redundancy. So this is work that Elad has done. And so if you look at instances where two cells fire spikes synchronously, basically what you find is that it's almost always redundant, you know, quite highly redundant. So, you know, this is the synergy, and I flip sign. Sorry about that. So negative values are now redundant, you know, those are the error bars. So most of the time, when neurons fire spikes synchronously, it's quite redundant. One thing to kind of note about that is that if you look at the information that the spike pair, let's say, so one cell fires a spike, you look at the minimum information that you get for pairing that with any other neuron, and basically it's always greater than information in one spike alone. So spike pairs always tell you more than a single spike alone, just not very much more, tiny bit more. We think that most of what they tell you is not that there's something different happening in the stimulus, but they allow you to to kind of know what the stimulus was with a little bit greater confidence. So, for instance, if we look at the variance of stimuli given a synchronous spiking event compared to the variance of one spike alone, the synchronous event has systematically lower variance. So, you know, two spikes fired together, you know, gives you a little bit more information than one spike, and we think that a lot of that is due to kind of knowing what the stimulus is with greater confidence, even though your estimate might be the same. Okay, but then silence is something that can potentially be very valuable in a combination. So when a cell is silent all by itself, it tells you essentially nothing. You know, the cells are so sparse, you get kind of zero information from that. But in combination with another cell spiking, you actually can get significant synergy. So this is a distribution of synergy when one cell spikes, the other cell is silent for different stimulus conditions. You know, sometimes you lose information. More often, you gain information from that combination. And let me kind of explain why that happens. So the way that you gain information is when the conditioning on silence of one cell kind of cleanly vetoes a subset of firing events. So here's the firing rate of cell A alone. In red down here, this is cell A firing, and you know for sure that cell B was silent. What that does is it kind of wipes out, you know, certain times when cell A would have fired, but it leaves other times unchanged. So what that does is it selects kind of a subset of stimulus events that this compound symbol will signal. And so if you take the, let's say, event-triggered average of this cell spiking plus cell B silent, that's shown here in red, and it's you know, significantly different from the spike-triggered average of A alone. And it turns out that, you know, a pattern like this, you know, we've never seen in the population of individual cells. So it's kind of a different you know, stimulus feature encoded by this combination of spiking plus silence of another neuron that no individual neuron encodes. And, you know, in this example, the synergy was half a bit. Okay, so, but then I showed that, you know, some combinations are gain information, some lose information. Basically, what happens is that if you condition, if, you know, the cell, let's see, so if you condition on silence for a cell that's the same kind of fine functional type as the cell that spiked, then you generally lose information That's because the two cells are saying things that are so similar that it's nothing new, and you kind of lose signal to noise ratio because you veto like most of the spikes. But for particular combinations where the cells are of slightly different functional type, which I could define in more detail later, then you systematically gain information. So, and then if cells are very, very different, then they tend to, spiking plus silence tends to be independent. So, you know, you have to have cells that are functionally similar in order to, and then also have some redundancy in order to make it possible for this conditioning on silence to tell you something new. You know, silence of neurons is very common. You might wonder what happens if you condition on silence of several neighboring neurons. And it turns out that the synergy roughly adds. So here we looked at the synergy with one cell A versus three other cells that are silent. We just added that up versus the synergy condition on all three of them silent. And the synergy seems to roughly add. So if you condition on the silence of more cells, you kind of gain much, much more synergy.
So different types?
Here it's not restricted to be that way. And, you know, so there's some scatter, and, you know, sometimes the total synergy is, you know, zero or even negative. So so we didn't try to restrict it here. And so the cumulative effect, this is kind of a distribution of synergy values for spiking with one cell silent, two cell silent, three cells silent. You know, it really becomes a much stronger effect. So one cell condition on three neighboring cells silent can sometimes give you more than 2 bits of synergy. So it's really a big effect. And actually, on average, you tend to get significant synergy from any one of these combinations. Now, you know, presumably a lot of these, you know, kind of values down there are when you combined with another cell of the same kind of fine functional type. But the fact that on average there's pretty big synergy suggests that, you know, maybe one strategy for the brain to recognize these events is just to randomly select some of them and then, you know, have a learning mechanism to reinforce whether it's useful.
Are these the normalized synergy
bits? No, this is raw bits. Yeah.
So these are real bits. How can it be larger than the sum of
entropy?
Can it be?
Let's see. Synergy per symbol has some different mathematical properties than the synergy averaged over all the responses. So, I mean, the individual spikes, you know, tend to have more information than two bits. But I think, I mean, in principle, you could get, you know, more synergy than the information in the spike alone. That's possible.
Yeah,
and not only information in the joint spiking, then you see nothing at the level of single cell, and only when you see both of them, you
know. Yeah, but that's, it's bounded by the entropy of the combination.
So yeah, and we don't over.
Yeah, okay.
We don't break that.
Yeah, so
still well below that.
Yeah, and okay, and you know, you might wonder how the brain would recognize combinations like that, and it's really pretty simple. You know, the idea is you have an excitatory direct connection from, you know, cell A, make you sensitive to its spike, and then cell B excites an inhibitory interneuron which inhibits, you know, the cell or the dendrite. And, you know, so the idea is that if B fires its spike, then that kind of vetoes or neutralizes the effect on the postsynaptic cell. So now this cell will sort of only notice when A fires a spike and B was silent. And it's, of course, very easy to imagine generalizing to the silence of more cells. They just all synapse with excitatory connections onto the inhibitory neuron, and then you're conditioned on all those cells being silent. So it's very easy to imagine, you know, how the brain would compute these sorts of combinations. And in fact, you know, it's known from work of, you know, Connors and some others that there are these feed-forward inhibitory neurons in cortex, and they're also there in optic tectum. You know, so they're a pretty common feature of neural circuits. Okay, so
yeah. Like you're suggesting two opposite things.
Right.
I can't figure out which one.
Okay, so
not both. One is when cells are correlated, of course the information should increase because we found, or might increase. It does slightly. Presumably because the correlated responses are telling us something about a reliable feature in the environment.
Right.
And then you're also saying
but when those
essentially when everybody's silent except for one cell, so they're sort of anti correlated in this interesting way,
right,
then you also get an increase in information.
So the two cells firing together give you a little bit more information than one cell firing alone, but that combination is highly redundant because each spike is by itself so informative. So the synchronous event is highly redundant, but spiking plus silence is synergistic in many cases. And so, you know, the idea is that the two cells spiking together, that's kind of telling you the same thing, it kind of, you know, reiterating the same message, which gives you a little bit more confidence that that is really what happened. You know, but that information gain is, you know, not so big, so it's redundant. Whereas when a cell spikes and another cell is silent, then that's essentially telling you something about what are sort of the difference in function between these two neurons. And that's, yeah, the set, yeah.
Maybe I'm missing something. It seems like the synergy analysis had to give you the result that it gave you. Because the cells are sitting there most of the time not responding. And then some small fraction of the time, one of the cells responds and the other ones don't. And we're only considering the cases where that one cell responding is actually responding reliably. And under those circumstances, it seems like you can't help but get a huge boost in the synergy. Sort of like you've looked at
but
range of spike combinations that actually do lose the
synergy. Yeah, but remember, you know, here's you know, a lot of the time you actually lose information by conditioning on the silence of another cell. So it depends on what are the two cells,
right.
And you know, you're kind of right. If the two cells are similar but different, then yeah, you do tend to kind of always get some synergy, and that's kind of why you know, if you condition on, let's say, three cells being silent, you have very high probability of getting, you know, quite a lot of synergy out of that combination.
But if you did this for the cells that have similar filtering profiles, then that is going to be much less.
Yeah, it would be negative.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I have maybe an example of that. Here is a combination of, you know, here's one cell and the second cell is very, very functionally similar. What happens when you condition on the first cell spiking, second cell silent, is that, you know, you kind of just wipe out most of the spikes. The spike triggered average, let's say the orange and the purple are you know, are basically the same, but you've lost most of your spikes. So a combination like that causes you to actually have less information than the one cell alone. And of course, you know, there are many combinations that give you independence. If the two cells hardly fire together, they're really statistically independent, then you're not going to get any synergy from knowing that the other cell was silent. I will, that I'll just kind of end with that. You know, the idea, well, let me, so I, you know, I just want to, you know, mention some other things that, you know, it's interesting that this symbol of spiking plus silence is really pretty common, because most of the cells are silent most of the time. They're quite sparse. So that's not an incredibly rare symbol. It's actually pretty common. And, you know, remember the coverage factor is, you know, something like 50. So there are kind of many combinations of, you know, neurons that are functionally similar but not independent, you know, out of which you can build these combinations. So I think there's, you know, kind of a lot of potential for a code like this to be used to kind of extract different features of the stimulus from combinations of spiking plus silence. And that's and then I just want to show one last thing, which is another kind of project that we started, Ronan has been working on. You know, so kind of getting back to the this question of, you know, what is the benefit of knowing the information? You know, one of the things that's very useful about mutual information is that it puts a bound on, you know, the possible discriminations you can make about the stimulus. You know, firing rate doesn't tell you anything like that. So, you know, what we'd like to be able to do, you know, we can record, you know, all or nearly all the neurons in a patch of the retina. We'd like to be able to take that population response and predict, you know, behavior, you know, of the animal using, you know, a recording of the retina with the same stimulus. Salamander doesn't have the most impressive visual behavior. You know, it kind of missed the fish earlier. The archer fish is an animal that has very, very extreme visual behavior that is, it's very interesting in this regard. So it gets its name from the fact that it can shoot this jet of water out of its mouth and hit insects that are perched above it. The insect falls in the water, and then the fish can swoop over and eat the insect. And here is a clip of these guys in action. There are a couple of flies on a stick here, and the fish are kind of hiding. And here comes one. Got it. They're pretty fast. There's another fish that's going to get that second bug, but. So while you're watching that, I'll let's just watch here. Here he is. Kind of, are we around? Nope, not looking. Got it. They're really fast. Some neuroethologists have studied the behavior in more detail, and they can shoot accurately up to 2 meters away. And at that distance, the size of the insect on the retina is about 20 microns, which is much smaller than the receptive field of any of its ganglion cells. And so, you know, you really have a situation where it's going to have to use, you know, a population of neurons to get that spatial acuity. There's another behavior that it has that's in some ways even more impressive, which is that if one archer fish shoots the insect, neighboring archer fish will make a run for it, and they'll very often get the insect. And so, in these behavioral measurements, it turns out that what the archer fish does is when the first fish hits the insect, the second fish will very quickly, within 100 milliseconds, orient towards the position where the insect will splash down, and then it swims straight at it without any course correction. And so basically that implies that within 100 milliseconds it can figure out the velocity of the insect. And the distance it travels in that time is about the size of our array. And so basically, you know, there are, you know, all the ganglion cells in kind of a 50, you know, or kind of 150 micron patch have a chance to fire one burst, you know, and that is evidently enough for the animal to know the velocity of the insect. So that's another, you know, kind of extreme visual behavior that we want to try to, you know, predict by recording from the population. So the idea is to, you know, kind of make this connection to behavior to try to be a little more concrete about, you know, the aspect of the, you know, these aspects of the population code. I'll leave you with that. Thanks.
I'm curious about the comment you had in the previous slide about the synchrony among your another one there. So synchronous spikes are at the same time highly informative and mostly redundant. So they have to know that they are synchronous.
Those events by themselves give you a lot of information, you know, 5 bits, 8 bits. It's just that...
You're also saying that the spike.
Yeah, bits per event is pretty high, but it's less than the sum of the two spikes alone, because each spike...
There are presumably many synchronous spikes, so that's sort of a wave spiking or something. It can be not very efficient.
What do you mean? There are many of them.
Only two spikes.
Between two cells.
Two cells only.
Yeah. In that case, the number of synchronous events is, you know, quite a bit lower than number of events because each cell is so sparse. So you require that a second cell, you know, fire a spike and, you know, 10-20 milliseconds away from your spike, and then there's just not. Not a lot of spiking, but you're right. If you look at the entire population, when one cell fires, you know, I don't know, order 10 cells somewhere fired a spike. That's, you know,
so you actually roughly much less efficiency.
From this, yeah, the synchronous events are not efficient in terms of information.
I don't want to say anything about higher levels, something like synthetic chains or any synchronous mechanism.
Well, I mean, they give you, let's say, increased confidence about something being out there in the world, and so, you know, maybe that's very, very valuable.
So when you're thinking about this sort of population code, you have a pair of cells or four cells, and so there's one spiking and the other one non-spiking. What do you envision for sort of downstream is how to take this information, let's say the ganglion cell projects to a flank neuron? Are you assuming they're all sort of projecting to the same neuron? And if so, if you have one cell projecting to the dendrite versus the soma, you have different latencies between them. So you're talking about precisely correlated spikes that eventually have to be interpreted in some way. I'm just curious what you're thinking. I mean,
What I'm kind of thinking is that those you know spikes would kind of converge synchronously on like a dendrite, like one branch of the dendrite, and so you know if the inhibitory cell fires, it kind of nulls out the EPSP. If not, the EPSP gets through to the soma. So this isn't let's say that the only thing that cell is detecting is maybe what a dendrite is detecting, one kind of common theme as you go up the visual pathway is that cells are responsive to kind of a higher order feature, but they do so over like a bigger region of visual space. What you could imagine is this combination of one cell spiking plus three other cells silent. From like one receptive field location goes onto one dendrite, an adjacent receptive field location onto another dendrite. So let's say you could pool together like these combinations from many groups of neurons in slightly different spatial locations. You could kind of get sensitivity to this higher order feature, but generalize its spatial location. And of course, I mean, another thing to point out that's certainly true of the retina and in some ways true of the cortex is that there's this huge divergence of neurons. You know, so if number of optic nerve fibers, let's say in human is like 100 or 1,000 times less than the number of neurons in layer 4 of V1. You know, so there are many, many more receiving neurons, and so perhaps they really span the space of many of these combinations and kind of get a little bit have the potential to kind of be more precisely tuned, but then of course at some you don't want to kind of build every single one of these combinations. You know, some of them are not very, very useful, and some of them are very useful. So presumably there's also a learning process where you generate some of these connections and then keep them or not depending on a learning rule.
I was just wondering, just take your, if you had 100, right? So you had three bits, three things. Why don't you just consider all the bits? And why can't you do 101, 110? Wouldn't all those give you more information again?
So we're starting to look at some of those other combinations. One thing to kind of keep in mind is that as you kind of add all these conditions, like the event rate gets lower and lower. So the individual event might be more specific and informative, but it happens less and less often. So when you're kind of thinking about the next level, there needs to be some kind of trade-off between getting very specific information and then just doing something. So that's kind of why I maybe think of that computation happening on a dendrite. So now the neuron could spike if it gets one of a few of these different combinations.
But you could expand that when you have a specific two or three cells, but you expand it into a much larger group of cells. And then some ideal observer looking at a large population, you would make less
sense. And mostly zero.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
When this sort of stuff would work, the ganglion cells have to project to the same place.
Yeah.
So it might be interesting to take this approach and then to label the cells retrogradedly from the
ganglion. Yeah. So yeah.
Like, yeah. Maybe you'd be able to do this and sort out which ones actually could be back.
Yeah, although it's, it's important to keep in mind that in some sense most of the ganglion cells respond to the primary visual areas. In rabbit, I assume this is true in guinea pig, like 97% of the ganglion cells project to the superior colliculus. so if you do that labeling, you'll find like everything is there at the level of the colliculus. Smaller fraction to the thalamus, but then in salamander, they pretty much all project to the optic tectum. So, at least in these animals, the dominant kind of projection area in the brain gets kind of everything. But in humans, let's say half of the ganglion cell coverage goes to thalamus, half goes to colliculus in terms of not neurons but coverage factor. Roughly. Yeah.
So is that fair to say that this correlation, the redundancy you observe, are mostly local? When you go further away?
That's right. It's mostly for neurons with overlapping receptive fields. Yeah.
Right. So in that sense, it's not contradict the intuition code because
it's
not
right.
Necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in the interest of time, I didn't add that part to the talk, but we've looked at redundancy in the stimulus and compared to ganglion cells and linear filtering of the receptive field. And basically, the center surround antagonism gives you, you know, very significant redundancy reduction. And the ganglion cells, you know, have very little redundancy kind of beyond the overlapping receptive field centers. I mean, there's a little bit, but it's not zero, but it's quite low. So there really is a lot of redundancy reduction for cells, you know, beyond the overlapping receptive fields. But then, you know, so this redundancy is coming from the fact that there's this really high coverage. You know, that's kind of a design choice of the retina. Like, it didn't have to build, you know, such overlapping receptive fields, you know, but it did. And so, you know, that's you know, mostly where it's coming from.
But
And I mean, again, kind of getting back to the issue of spatial acuity, I mean, I think, you know, at least it seems to me naively, spatial acuity is determined by the density of the cells, like the spacing between their exact center coordinates. And even if they have more or less receptive field overlap, it first order doesn't matter, because you can look at kind of ratios of their response to kind of interpolate, you know, position kind of on a scale less than the receptive field size. So I think that having this large coverage, you know, doesn't necessarily compromise spatial acuity. You mean like the biophysics? It's kind of frustrating to do that, because you get something kind of biphasic with about the same shape in the photoreceptor, photoreceptor inner segment, not the outer segment. It seems like there are, in some sense, like every neuron anyone's ever looked at is kind of has a biphasic impulse response, and there are many ways of doing that. You know, so in the photoreceptor inner segment, it's probably a calcium activated potassium channel that kind of gives this time delayed inhibition. At the network level, many amacrine cells, as Peter kind of talked about, they get excitation from a bipolar cell terminal, and then they have an inhibitory synapse that feeds right back that gives time delayed inhibition to, you know, right to the bipolar cell terminal. So that's kind of another, and horizontal cells do the same thing to the photoreceptor axonal terminal. So there are you know, kind of circuit level mechanisms kind of everywhere you look that do. Yeah, exactly.
I think we should get some lunch.
Yeah. Thanks.